Hey there, everyone. Welcome back to episode 2 of the Jeff Robichaux podcast. I'm Jeff Robichaux. If you didn't get a chance to listen to episode 1, which I released on over the weekend, go back, take a listen to it. I'll give you the quick Coles notes of it. It's basically the origins story of where my battle with mental illness had started. I lost my mother when I was 11 years old back in 1992, and that's really where things started to fall off the wagon for me, if you may. There's been a lot of challenges in my life over the last 32 years. I'm having a hard time dealing with, you know, some childhood trauma, my anxiety, addiction, and also living with a condition called dissociative identity disorder. We'll talk a little bit more about the addiction and dissociative identity disorder probably in the next episode of the podcast. But for today, we're going to talk a little bit about how the anxiety and childhood trauma has affected me. Again, going all the way back to that fateful day in July of 1992. So, with that being said, let's get into it, shall we? So basically, after my mother passed away, and we started to return back to reality, the family, my father, my sister, and I, Dad had to go back to work because he had spent so much time being laid off and spending the time with my mother while she was battling her battle with cancer. And so when he went back to work, he basically took the first job he could find. And my father was a hard-working blue-collar man. He would eventually end up taking a job working overnights. He would go into work sometimes around 8:30 at night and not come home till 10 o'clock the next morning. So that started leaving this 11-year-old kid home alone for, you know, a bunch of hours for the most part every day. You know, in the summertime, Dad would go to work. He'd come home in the morning. I'd wake up and I'd go do my thing as an 11-year-old kid. I'd either go outside or just stay isolated, you know, trying to figure out what my feelings were after all that was said and done with my mother, after the funeral and after her passing. And my sister, when we got back to reality, she ended up going back to work for the rest of the summer, and then she returned to school in the fall. So when she went back to school, her schedule, she was usually out the door by 7:30 in the morning. So that would leave me having to get up, get myself ready, and get out the door. I did an okay job at, for the most part, I would think, since I really didn't miss much school. My father would come home after I'd leave for school. I'd come home for lunch and I'd get a chance to see my dad. He would go back to bed, I would leave, go back to school, and by the time I got home, he was still sleeping. Sherry would be still working, so I would be pretty much alone for the better part of the afternoon and into the evening. Now, if I had baseball practice, someone would come by and pick me up, bring me to the ball field, bring me home. And sometimes that coincided that I'd end up missing my father. I'd get back from ball. He would already be out the door going to work. Sherry would still be at work. And she wouldn't get home till 10 o'clock at night. So the therapist said that it was really neglect. But it wasn't neglect like most people would see it. See neglected kids. It's not like it was anything on purpose. Like, you know, it's not as if my father was an alcoholic or addicted to drugs or anything like that. But it was a neglect and a necessity because Dad had to do what he had to do to keep the roof over our heads. And my sister had to do what she had to do to be able to afford to have money to be able to pay for her schooling. So there I was, an 11-year-old kid who really had no adult supervision, if that makes sense. He really had no adult role model who could guide him in the right direction of being able to teach me how to be accountable. You know, my father never got back into any relationships, so I never really knew about intimate relationships. So I wish I kind of had a little bit of influence like that over the years after Mom's passing, because that would have really helped a lot in my development. But instead, it turned into me isolating myself quite a bit. With the loss of my mother, it did cause me to have some real big childhood trauma. I had some real big memory loss. I really don't remember much of my childhood from being born to age 11. My memories from age 11 up were of what my mother looked like while she was fighting cancer. And, you know, what I remember her being as when I had a chance to see her on my birthday. definitely wasn't the greatest childhood from age 11 up. The anxiety that I started to suffer from, I suffer from a big, huge case of separation anxiety. And I will get into talking about that a little bit later on, because I feel it needs to be talked about so that some people have a better idea of how and why I was acting the way I was acting. The trauma also led to me to having some learning issues, if that makes sense. You know, my mother was the one who was the one at the house who was really pushing the schooling. She would work with me. I do remember her working with me on my schooling in my early days of school. But other than that, I really don't have much of a memory of what my childhood was like. I remember my mom usually getting frustrated when she seen how clean and crisp my handwriting could be. But instead, most of the time, my handwriting ended up looking like what my father's did. And, well, Dad should have been a doctor. That's how good his handwriting was. So there are times I have a hard time expressing myself and wording things properly, and it leads to people being insulted or getting upset with me because of the way I worded certain things. And I have always had a big, hard time of just slowing down and thinking before I speak. And that is, again, part of a little bit of a learning issue that I've had over the years. Also, with the type of anxiety that I have, some people would think it comes off as being a little bit narcissistic. And I get how people could see that coming off as being a bit narcissistic, because a child with separation anxiety is always looking for constant reassurance from the person that they are attached to. They are constantly looking for that feeling of, do you really want me there? Is everything going to be okay if I go there? Just looking for that reassurance. Sometimes that type of diagnosis can also be misdiagnosed as being a narcissist. And I was actually misdiagnosed way back in 2016, actually, with my first psychologist that I was talking with. And he actually did diagnose me as having dissociative identity disorder and narcissism. He didn't believe that my separation anxiety was that bad, that it came off as anxiety, and he thought it came off more as being a narcissist. But with my current therapist, her viewpoint on it is, if you were a true narcissist, you would not have the ability to step up and get the help and start seeing a therapist to work with you. And that really took a huge weight off my shoulders when she said that to me. So again, what causes some anxiety issues? Well, I was just kind of reading a few published papers on some reputable medical sites. The Mayo Clinic in the U.S. is being one of them. And they say that the causes of anxiety disorder aren't fully understood, but they do say life experiences such as trauma events appear to trigger anxiety disorders in people who are already prone to anxiety. And they also say some inherited traits also can be some factors in someone with really, really bad anxiety. Common signs or symptoms, I should say, are, you know, feeling nervous, restless, or tense, a sense of impending danger, panic or doom, increased heart rate, breathing rapidly, sweating, trembling, feeling weak or tired, trouble concentrating or thinking about anything other than the present that they're worrying about, having trouble sleeping, having difficulty controlling their worry, and having the urge to avoid things that trigger anxiety. I had me one of those such instances a few months back. My last relationship, her best friend's husband had passed away, and she was a big part on helping getting the funeral arrangements all set up. She needed me to be there. I should have gone and been with someone to support her. But the problem was, the way she approached it, she basically said, yes, I want you there, but I'm going to tell you now, my attention is not going to be fully on you. It'll be elsewhere. I'll be busy doing other stuff. And so with my therapist, when I told her that, she said, oh, so she was basically putting conditions on you being there. And also for someone who had the anxiety level as bad as I did, to me, that says I was going to be a burden to her if I was there. Now, did she mean it that way? I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think that she would be that malice. In fact, I know she wouldn't be that malice, I should say. But it's just the way that the wording about me going came off that it literally crippled me. And I could not bring myself to going out in that social situation, knowing that or feeling like I was going to be a burden if I was there. Because when you deal with someone whose anxiety is as high as mine, you do have to have some sort of sensitivity when you talk to them. Because people's anxiety doesn't have to make sense to you, but you do have to understand that what their anxiety that they're going through, to them it's real, and you have to be real sensitive. You have to have a big sense of empathy towards that person who's dealing with the anxiety attack, and you just got to reassure them. You got to let them know that everything is going to be okay, that you'll do what you can to make sure the anxiety level is not so bad that there is a breakdown or that there is a scene that gets caused. I know in past instances, I have really caused some real terrible scenes when it comes to my anxiety taking control of me. It was just nervousness and being scared of being rejected, because although my mother passed away and it wasn't her fault that she left, quote unquote, it still made me feel like a bit of a rejected child growing up. And I never really dealt with that, even as an adult. So going into certain social areas or social events, it was tough. I mean, I did manage to push through to the first Christmas that I went to, when I really had nowhere to go for my first Christmas back in 2019, since I'd moved back to New Brunswick. The way that this person worded the event just took my mind off everything, and it just made it so easy for me to go through with that. But then you fast forward to, 5 years later, and it's, I want you to come, but my attention's not going to be on you full time. And then, of course, it led me into feeling like I was going to be a burden if I was there for the whole weekend. Essentially, it made me look like a total arsehole who did not care. Where in reality, I cared. I cared so much about what was going on that weekend. And I tried to convey that to everyone. But the problem is I really didn't learn empathy growing up. And they say that that is a learned behavior. And you're supposed to learn that from watching your parents when you grow up. And not having that family dynamic for that, and for, how to be able to have an intimate relationship with a woman, with a partner, which is something we're going to get into a little bit later on down the road as well, because that comes in as part of my addiction and part of my dissociative identity disorder. So keep that in the back of your mind for the next episode, because the next episode is going to get a little more graphic and a little more hot topic button, something like that. So keep that in mind. There are times where my anxiety did come off as being a narcissist or being narcissistic. Look at me, please. But it was just really an 11-year-old child acting out, trying to get that reassurance that he was wanted and needed in a certain place. Not, yes, you can come, I'm not going to be able to pay attention to you the whole time. And if you know anyone who has anxiety like that, you like I said, you do have to have a certain amount of empathy to deal with someone who has crippling anxiety. And again, people's anxieties do not have to make sense to you, but you do have to understand that people with that anxiety, what they're experiencing to them is real and does require some sensitivity. And there's all kinds of ways that you can talk to people with anxiety, and there's all kinds of great papers that are written online from some really reputable clinics who do research on this type of stuff. So, if you know anyone that's suffering with anxiety and you're having a hard time communicating with them, take a read of some of those articles, and let me tell you, the way you communicate with them using some of those techniques will totally change your relationship with them. You know, with the fact that the event going on that I could not walk, get myself to go out the door to attend, this person who was very special to me felt abandoned for the entire weekend. And it wasn't the fact that I was abandoning her. It's the fact that I did not know how to cope and keep my anxiety in check to be able to attend, to be there with her and be her rock. And to this day, and to the day I take my last breath, I am going to apologize to her about this. Because all I can say to her right now is I'm sorry that I was not stronger and I was not able to push through to be there for her on that particular event. And I'm very sorry, and I hope that eventually that she will be able to find it in her to forgive me about my actions. You know, just having a conversation recently about that recent event and how bad my anxiety was. And I guess I just failed to communicate on how bad my abandonment issues were. My abandonment issues actually came off as me being controlling. You know, when you have someone who was as young as I was when I lost a parent, you're scared that when you're in a relationship and your partner wants to go out somewhere without you, you start freaking out. And you always start thinking the worst. You know, you think she's going to go out and leave and not come back. Something bad's going to happen to her while she's out and about. I can see how that comes off as controlling when that person doesn't want the other person to go. And again, that's another thing I'm extremely sorry about that I didn't open up about earlier on in that relationship. The bottom line is now, is I'm trying to break that cycle of being an 11-year-old child. I'm trying to learn to be accountable. I'm trying to learn how to have intimate relationships. And not, when I say intimate relationships, I'm not just saying sex and stuff like that. I mean, really breaking it down and, you know, having that connection with that special someone. And sometimes that partner of the one who has anxiety has to be patient and has to understand that sometimes it's not easy for someone to come out of his shell and be who he is. The problem is with that, for me, in this last relationship I was in, I had my head so far up my arse that I was blind to see how patient that she was being with me. And she told me over and over again, I needed to get help. I needed to see someone to work on this, to control it. And again, I was still in denial about everything, really, about the childhood trauma and the anxiety, even though my actions were right there, were right in front of my face. I was still in denial about it. And I can see how it would come off as being narcissistic, egotistical, controlling. But it was just a 11-year-old kid trapped in a 42-year-old's body looking for acceptance and looking for reassurance and hearing those words that everything was going to be okay. Were those words said? I honestly do not remember. I would say they probably were because that's the type of person that this girl that I was in this last relationship with is. But I was just too blind to see it. And I know she's listening, and I want to say sorry to her again about my actions, about not opening up even more than what I did to you about how bad my separation anxiety was and how bad the childhood trauma was that I suffered. I appreciate you staying in contact with me throughout this whole growing process. And as I said in the first episode, I really, really hope that sometime down the road that there can be a reconciliation, because I really, truly believe you are the one for me. So we've gone on here for about 24 minutes now. I think we're going to wrap it up for this episode. So the next episode, as I mentioned, we're going to get into my issues with dissociative identity disorder and addiction. And again, I will say this now, listener discretion is advised. It is going to be quite the heavy topic, topics, I should say, in the next episode here on the podcast. So I do thank everyone who's taken the time to download it and take a listen to it. I'm just trying to get my story out there just so I'm not as misunderstood as I probably am to some people right now. And hopefully this is clearing some stuff up. Maybe you're not believing anything I'm saying. But again, a lot of the stuff that I'm going over is stuff that's coming directly from my therapist that I'm dealing with. This therapist is good. And with the lack of available therapists in the province, I actually had to do some research and see if I could find something possibly that could work for me online. And I found this therapist who's based actually down in Tennessee. And I've been doing one session a week with her. And this girl's really good. She deals with U.S. military. And not just that, like, you know, special forces military. She deals with Delta Forces. She has dealt with some Navy SEALs. So she is really good at her job. And so all the information that I'm passing on to you is stuff that's being pulled directly from our sessions. So I am really excited about where these sessions are taking me right now. And I'm just super excited that I was able to get matched up with this therapist, and wow, just, I cannot say enough good things about her. And she specializes in, you know, trauma, in people with anxiety. I'm only her seventh case of dissociative identity disorder, so she does have experience in that, and she does have experience with people who use addictions as coping mechanisms as well. So this is absolutely awesome. She has been nothing but fantastic to me, and she's been kind of a great sounding board, and I'm excited to continue my treatments with her, and I'm excited to keep building, and I'm excited to keep sharing my story, and I'm hoping you guys are enjoying it so far, and I do hope you guys will continue to listen as I continue this journey down the road to learning and growing, making amends to certain people, and just trying to become a overall better person. So that being said, that is episode 2 of the Jeff Robichaux Podcast. Thanks for listening. We will be back with our next episode. I'm going to try and post it midweek. No guarantees because, you know, I have this other thing called a day job that kind of throws a little damper into doing this type of show. So we'll see how busy my work week is. If I don't get back to the next episode by midweek, I definitely will have the next episode posted Sunday evening. I would like to try and get the third episode, the one that I think is going to be kind of a bit of an eye-opener for a lot of people. I'm looking forward to getting that one out before the start of next week. So again, thanks for everyone who has taken the opportunity to listen. I hope you guys keep listening, and hopefully the story will make a little more sense to you and you're enjoying it. So thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.